Welcome to the Whiskey Rebellion. This is David Silkenet in Edinburgh, and I'm joined as always by my co-host Frank Cogliano. How are you doing this week, Frank?
I'm doing great, David. How are you?
I'm doing good. We just finished the academic year in a way. We released exam results and all the kinds of things yesterday, so the students are all mostly happy, and so summer has officially started, sort of.
Sort of. We're still in Scotland.
Yes, it's gray and cloudy outside, as it tends to be. All right, so we've got two big topics for this week. One, we want to talk about the shooting earlier this week at a Republican congressional baseball practice, and try to provide some sort of context for that event. And the second topic, and these don't really fit together in any kind of meaningful way, but we wanted to have a slightly more lighthearted and pop culture kind of topic. We both saw Wonder Woman in the past week, and so we want to sort of deconstruct that as a work of film and as a sort of historical artifact, and how it fits into the mythology of Wonder Woman, and Wonder Woman fits into the sort of broader themes of American history.
It's our summer blockbuster episode.
Oh, we're going to have lots of guys talking about Spider-Man later. That's great. You know, all kinds of things. We're both comic book... I'm probably more of a comic book nerd than you are, but we're both comic book nerds, so we will enjoy deconstructing Wonder Woman. All right. So, first, Frank, do you want to... I know probably everybody listening to this knows what happened a few days ago at the baseball practice, but you want to give the Cliff Note version to remind people of what happened?
Sure. So several days ago, very early in the morning, it was just after 7 a.m. local time in Alexandria, Virginia, a 66-year-old man from Illinois approached a group of Republican congressmen, I think it was all men actually, who were practicing for the annual congressional baseball game, a team of Republicans against a team of Democrats.
And they take this very seriously.
They take it very seriously. We can talk about that in due course. Yes, they do take it very seriously. It's gone on for over a century, mm-hmm. this game. And the Republicans were practicing for this game, as I said, early in the morning. And this gentleman approached, apparently asked a passerby whether they were Democrats or Republicans out on the field. He was told Republicans. He said thank you very much, and then he opened fire. Several people were injured, including a congressman from Louisiana named Steve Scalise. Representative Scalise is a fairly conservative individual. He described himself as David Duke without the baggage, David Duke being a prominent member of the KKK. And two members of the Capitol Police who were in attendance eventually engaged in a kind of exchange of gunfire with this gentleman, killing him and putting an end to this incident. They were only there because Representative Scalise is the majority whip in the House of Representatives. And since 9/11 in 2001, the security details that some members of Congress were given... the list of members of Congress given security details was expanded slightly. And because the majority whip is in the line of succession, Representative Scalise has a security detail. And there were two members of the Capitol Police Force present, and they intervened and brought this incident to an end by killing the shooter. It's worth observing by way of... irony, I suppose, that Representative Scalise has, as I said, identified himself with David Duke, which is an odd association at one point in his career. He's also a fierce opponent of LGBTQ rights and a proponent of what he calls traditional marriage. The two police officers from the Capitol Police Force who intervened and protected the members of Congress, including Representative Scalise, were African American, and one of them is a lesbian. So yeah. It's a little bit ironic there.
He's also a strong NRA supporter.
Yes. And several people said, you know, if a couple of congressmen in the aftermath of this, I think we need to give people a break for things they say in the immediate aftermath of an incident like this. But one of them said, well, I'm going to start carrying my gun everywhere. Since it was baseball practice, I don't think that it's probably recommended activity to kind of bring your gun out on the field. But again, I think things people say in extremis in the immediate aftermath of an event like this need to be forgiven. So that's the background. But David, when we were thinking about this as a topic, we were thinking about the history of political violence in the United States. Yeah. And I immediately thought back to the shooting of Congresswoman Gabby Giffords of Arizona in 2011.
Sure.
And she was shot at a kind of public event. I think it was in a car park or a parking lot of a supermarket.
You've been living here too long. Car park?
Yeah, okay. Our listenership is global, David. and so Representative Giffords was very seriously injured, and in fact, to some extent, it's a miracle she survived.
And I think several people were killed in that event.
That's right. So a handful of people were killed, and she was badly wounded. In fact, the U.S. Navy just commissioned a ship.
Ship, I saw that.
Named after her this week. Anyway, so there was the shooting of Gabby Giffords 6 years ago. There was this terrible incident this week, which fortunately nobody but the shooter was killed. Although Representative Scalise is listed as critical at the hospital, I think. So we have these incidents, but do two incidents a trend make? What does this tell us? So is political violence? Look, we know that the United States is bedeviled with all manner of violence.
Yes,
and that's not really our necessarily what we're talking about today. But I'm thinking about political violence, and by political violence, I mean violence directed at office holders. So let's be fairly narrow in our definition of this. Is this a problem in American history, or is it a trend in American history? These are two data points.
So I think we can divide, I think, the violent, we can divide it lots of ways, but one of the interesting things I think about this shooting is that there's relatively few attacks upon Congress people. Right? We have had lots of people try to kill presidents.
Despite the fact that people hate Congress, or at least polls show that.
Yes. We've had lots of attacks on presidents. We've had four presidents assassinated. We've had several others who had sort of close, near assassinations or attempted assassinations.
And we've had governors assassinated.
And we've had governors assassinated. So executives tend to be targets for political violence. Congress people tend not to be. There's been relatively few cases of Congress people being targeted. So we've got, obviously, this one this week. We've got Gabby Giffords. Looking back historically, we've got... In 1954, there was an... There was an incident in which four Puerto Rican nationalists charged into the U.S. Capitol and shot, I believe, five or six congresspeople. They sort of sprayed the room with gunfire. They didn't kill anybody, but miraculously. And that was clearly a political act. They were interested in independence for Puerto Rico. There had been an attempt a few years earlier to kill President Truman, also by Puerto Rican nationals. So there's this moment in the Puerto Rican independence movement during the 1950s where there's a very radical wing using violence, seeing violence as the sort of preferred route for that. Going back earlier than that, we have a handful of clear incidents. We have 1935, Huey Long being assassinated. During Reconstruction, there's a handful of Congress people who are killed. They tend to be Republicans in the South who were killed usually in local events, not in Washington. And then before that, there's a handful of congresspeople who kill each other in duels. But violence against congresspeople tends to be relatively rare, I would say, compared to violence against, say, executives. And I think the reason for this, if we can sort of get inside the heads of the people who want to kill politicians, is that killing a congressperson doesn't actually change very much, right? If you've got 400 plus members of Congress and you kill one of them, that's not going to change anything. Whereas if you kill an executive, the rationale would be that actually does have immediate political consequences.
Sure. I mean, I take your point, and although you're assuming a kind of rational calculation being made by the people who are.
Oh, to be sure.
And if one thinks, I mean, you're right about that. I mean, I have to confess, and I follow American politics pretty closely. Mm-hmm. I hadn't heard of Steve Scalise before Tuesday or of this week. So You're right about that. But if one thinks about high-profile figures like Mitch McConnell in the Senate or Paul Ryan. Paul Ryan and Nancy Pelosi, the leaders of the majority and the minority in Congress, for example, are two very high-profile figures. They're also very, very, you know, they engender a lot of animosity on the left and right. They have protection, of course, so we don't know what threats they're subjected to that we don't hear about.
I think they could probably get lots of threats. If you're thinking about sort of the amount of security in D.C. right now, you know, one can imagine the shooter on earlier this week had posted all these kinds of things on Facebook and whatnot about him hating Trump. Getting at the president right now would be extraordinarily hard, and I think part of the reason this target was picked is you have a bunch of congressmen outside of D.C. Playing baseball, so the security is usually very low, and in this case, there happen to be two congressional policemen there as a consequence of the leadership being there, but they're much softer targets. I don't think Paul Ryan is going off and is easily accessible.
No, although I guess proving your point rather than refuting it, congressmen do lots of events in their constituencies.
Sure.
Just meeting folks,
yes.
And so the opportunities at these and at these town hall meetings,
I think Congress people in particular, especially people in the House, have this tension between wanting to be accessible to their constituency and not being. There's great value being placed in seeing your constituents in the grocery store and doing that sort of door to door retail politics that seems to still be part of the American political ethos, even if it doesn't actually happen all that much. I think part of them don't want to be behind security guards. They want to interact with the general public. On the other hand, I think increasingly now, especially after the shooting earlier this week, I'm betting a bunch of them are probably going to use this as a justification not to engage with the public.
Well, yeah, and I saw a little bit of traffic on Twitter this week from Republican congressmen and women saying just that in the current climate, I'm canceling my town halls. Now,
they were canceling the town halls before the shooting, too. But
yes, that's right. I think that might be politically expedient, frankly. Although it's easy for me to say. I mean, I'm not in the public eye of being threatened by people. So it's perhaps we should take the threat seriously.
No, to be sure. I don't want to, people should look out for their own safety, by all means. But
is there... Clearly, there's a partisan dimension to this because one of the things one saw, so this was an attack on Republican congressmen. This was an attack which was carried out by a man who apparently was a volunteer for Bernie Sanders, mm-hmm. and as you alluded to in his social media profile, was rather outspoken in his criticism of President Trump and the Republican Party. And it was very, very... There was a very prominent... this appeared very prominently in social media and in right-wing news agencies and so on, like Breitbart and things like this, where there was a kind of trope that emerged that Democrats are responsible for violence. And Donald Trump Jr., in fact, said as much. That the Democrats and the rhetoric of contemporary politics has led to this violence, and that the violence comes from the left. This was, I think, Newt Gingrich said it as explicitly as that. Do you agree with that interpretation, David?
No. I think this is... I think the this kind of political violence occurs when people feel like they don't have... Assuming a rational basis for things, which is obviously a big assumption. But I think it occurs when people feel like they don't have a legitimate political outlet for the anger and resentment they feel. And so I don't think it's particular to the left. I mean, if anything, I think the right is equally violent. You can look at sort of the violence that's been, that occurred in conjunction with some of the, during the campaign, where there was violence at Republican rallies, at Trump rallies, where... reporters were assaulted. So I think that there's a lot of violence, I think, on... I think the polarization, I think, is the other sort of big feature to it. The American politics is polarized to the extent now where, you know, there aren't that many moderates left in Congress, aren't that many moderates left really anywhere in the political discourse. And I think that, you know, the violence, I think, is one of the symptoms of that.
Yeah, I mean, I have two observations in response to that, David. One is there was a story in this morning's New York Times bearing out exactly what you've said. There's data in this story which argues quite persuasively, in my view, that the kind of polarization along partisan lines is greater than it has been at least in the last 50 years in the United States.
And I think the time when you had this amount of polarization was last time was like probably in the 1850s, you know, when congressmen actually are killing each other either in duels or trying to assault each other in the floors of Congress. You know, where you have, you know, really irreconcilable differences on major political questions and people not seeing, you know, other congressional leaders as being legitimate in their worldview.
Yeah, I mean...
Now, granted, like, we know how that played
out. Yeah, we do know how the 1850s played out. That's not so good. But I'll make my second observation in a second. But to follow up on that, I would say one of the differences between the 1850s and now is, of course, in the 1850s, there was an issue, which was slavery.
Yes.
The story in this morning's Times basically said there's not necessarily an issue that Democrats and Republicans disagree over, except they see the world entirely different ways now, and there's very little common ground. And that gets to my second point, which is it is ironic that the shooter in this case attacked congressmen as they were preparing to participate in this baseball game. This congressional baseball game, and you alluded to it at the beginning, they take it very seriously. It goes, I mean, it's interesting, it's baseball and not softball.
Yes.
When I first heard the report, I thought, oh, it must have been a softball practice. No, they were playing hardball, as it were. Mm-hmm. But that this game goes back over a century. It's taken very seriously, but it's one of the few places where Democrats and Republicans socialize together because of technology. Cheap air travel allows congressmen and women to return to their districts every weekend, which they increasingly do. They don't stay in Washington and socialize with each other.
I think that's a big difference. That's a fairly recent development.
That's right. But this was there's an irony here that this was one of the few institutions or customs where Democrats and Republicans still socialize together and seem to do so, although the game is taken seriously. The spirit of it is bipartisan.
Yeah.
And in fact, the Democrats won last night and gave the trophy. They played the game, and they insisted on going ahead with the game. But they played the game last night, and the Democrats won. But they gave the trophy to the Republicans. So that kind of comedy,
yes,
is relatively rare now because of the culture of Congress and the culture of the country.
Yeah, I mean, they don't know each other as well as I think they used to. You know, they don't do the sort of social event. They don't go to the same dinner parties or things at the Kennedy Center. The thing about baseball, though, in terms of as a social event to get to know the other side, you don't actually interact with the people on the other team all that much.
Well, you're doing your own base. Players do spend a fair amount of time standing around talking to each other.
But they also spend a lot of time in the dugout, you know.
Yeah,
and so it's not... I think ideal... What I would love to see is actually if they had the teams and they split it up, like had some random distribution of players where it's Eastern states versus Western states or something, where you don't have, you know, us versus them mentality, which seems to be, you know, the...
Yeah, I mean, this does reinforce partisan divisions, but at least they're on the same field together.
Together, exactly. Okay, well, be on the same field together, I guess, is something. Okay.
But it's... I mean, you very ably sketched the history of this, David, and indeed you demonstrated that there is a history of violence against office holders in the United States that goes back through time. On the other hand, you said it's relatively rare. We've had two major incidents, the one this week and the shooting of Gabby Giffords 6 years ago. Is it getting worse? Will it get worse, I guess I'm asking you.
I'd hate to say 2 points doesn't, you know, create a trend necessarily, but given the sort of discourse generally around the country, I'm concerned that the number of people making threats of violence and the actual violence seems to be escalating at a deeply disconcerting rate.
Let's not forget, and I'm sure we'll get to this in another episode, we don't need to belabor this today, that owing to the Second Amendment, but also the current state of the regulation of firearms, the means to carry out these acts are more readily available than ever before.
Yeah, I mean, Virginia, where this took place, has very, very liberal gun laws where you can open carry and various things, and anyway.
Yes, although he was a Democrat from Illinois, which has very strict gun laws. Anyway, I'm sure we'll return to the Second Amendment and guns.
The gun story probably requires its own series of episodes, if nothing else. All right, let's move on to more fun topics besides political assassinations. You saw Wonder Woman this week. I saw Wonder Woman this week. What's your personal relationship with Wonder Woman? I'm not talking about me.
Yes, I'm married to a Wonder Woman, but that's not what you mean. In fact, I saw it with my wife, who is a very, very big fan, I should say, of Wonder Woman.
Did you grow up reading Wonder Woman?
Did I?
Yeah.
A little bit, not that much. She did.
Okay.
And so she, in fact, she had expectations that were disappointed because of her reading of Wonder Woman as a child. She actually grew up in Sweden, and she read Wonder Woman in Sweden. And so she was very upset there was no invisible airplane, for example, and things like this. I was always more of a Marvel guy than a DC guy, and we might get into this level of inside baseball, but and I think Marvel is better than DC in a lot of ways, so I was never a huge Wonder Woman fan. I was very, very impressed by and enjoyed the film a lot. My wife, the Wonder Woman fan, and her DC loyalty runs very deep. So we were walking back from the cinema, and she was talking about, well, you know, Superboy is great, but nobody reads Superboy. Come on. And, you know, and you know, her knowledge of the Justice League and all that sort of thing was much greater than my own. But she was disappointed because she didn't feel it was true to the spirit of what she'd grown up reading. I think she's wrong about that, but I shouldn't say this on tape. You know, one thing that the superhero genre does is reflect the time in which the film is made, or the comic book is made. So I think she had a fairly fixed view. She's a Wonder Woman fundamentalist, if you will.
I think all these characters, you know, are really malleable in some ways. And I think, Adam West, who just died, who played Batman, and his Batman, and what you saw, in the Dark Knight trilogy, those are superficially the same character, but that, you know, are really...
Well, that's right. Batman. I mean, Adam West Batman was groovy.
Yes.
You know, it was very a Batman of for people who were smoking dope in the 1960s, whereas Christian Bale's Dark Knight was, you know, it took, you know, noir to the, you know, the blackness of the universe. You know, I mean, it was very, very dark indeed. Although I think those were the most successful films. The Dark Knight trilogy of the last decade... Yeah. Were the most successful DC films. The DC films haven't been very successful until this one. I think this one is really
of the sort of fabulous. Modern generation.
Yeah, that's right.
Because
so I thought it was great. I can tell you why I thought it was great.
I liked it a lot. I mean, one of the interesting things about this film is that we've had, thinking about the DC characters and the three big DC heroes, Superman, Batman, Wonder Woman, all of which were created about the same time. You know, Batman and Superman are both late 30s. Wonder Woman is like 1941.
December 1941, right before Pearl Harbor.
That's a good time. you know, they all have this, whereas Superman and Batman have had numbers of films made about them, both good and bad. This is the first Wonder Woman film, you know, and I think I think that's interesting that it's taken so long for one of the three main characters in this, you know, in this triumvirate, who have been in comics together throughout this time period, you know, it took this long to actually make a Wonder Woman film, whereas, you know, greenlighting a Superman film doesn't, you know, they've had dozens of those.
Right. Whereas on the DC, on the Marvel side of the equation, they're down to Ant-Man and things like this. They're at sort of third and fourth level of superheroes where they're making films. But so you're right, Wonder Woman. It's amazing. I mean, she did have a... There was a TV series with Linda Carter in the 1970s.
Which I... Yeah, that was sort of my initiation into Wonder Woman was through watching, I guess, what would have been sort of syndicated reruns of that, of Linda Carter's Wonder Woman.
He's so young, listeners. I remember when it actually wasn't being rerun, but when it debuted.
Came out in 1975. I was negative two. At the point.
So, David, can you give us a little bit of the... I mean, Jill Lepore of Harvard and The New Yorker has written a book on the history of Wonder Woman. Can you give us a little bit of the background?
Yes.
Then we can talk about the film itself.
Yes. So it's a really interesting development of this character. The character was conceived of by a guy named William Moulton Marston, who is... if you want to I want to recommend Jill Lepore's book, and I guess there's an article in The New Yorker, which is the...
from a couple of years ago.
The condensed version of it. He is a really extraordinarily interesting, weird guy. He was, by training, both a lawyer and a psychologist. He doesn't seem to be particularly good at either of those things, but had a very, charismatic sort of demeanor, although he didn't tend to get along with a lot of people. One of the things he invented, or claimed to have invented, was an early version of the lie detector.
Yep.
And of course, Wonder Woman's,
lasso.
Lasso makes men tell the truth. So there's all these kinds of ways in which his personal biography sort of fits in with Wonder Woman. The other thing that's sort of interesting about him as a person is that he lived in a sort of polyamorous household with two and sometimes three other women, one of whom was the niece of Margaret Sanger. So there's all these kinds of ways in which he is living...
The
founder of Planned Parenthood, the sort of one of the sort of leading radical feminists in the first half of the 20th century. And, he's at Harvard at the time that there's this debate going on about women's suffrage in the 19-teens. And he creates this character as, in 1941 when it first comes out, as supposed to be a positive role model for both boys and girls. The early editions of Wonder Woman are very much this sort of radical feminist icon, where he's trying very explicitly in the, in the stories to champion a certain version of empowered womanhood. So that's the early version of Wonder Woman, and she's fairly successful early on. She joins sort of the predecessor to the Justice League. Although the Justice League, she was allowed to join, but she's the secretary,
right?
And all the other guys are men, even though she's probably the third most powerful person there. They make her the secretary because 1940s. Then there's a phase in Wonder Woman's history where it's often called the Diana Prince phase, where she basically sort of decides to live as a normal human being and do normal middle-class white woman stuff in America. So she still has her relationship with Steve Trevor, who's the sort of love interest through all these things. But it's a very sort of domesticated version of the character, where she isn't going and throwing tanks or whatever it is that she does, or fighting Nazis or fighting bad guys like she is in her early iterations. And then she's reinvented again in the 1970s, and you can see sort of relationship here with the development of different kinds of ideas of American femininity. She's reinvented in the 70s in large part because of Gloria Steinem. Gloria Steinem sort of remembered sort of this early version of Wonder Woman, puts her on the cover of Ms. Magazine, I think in 1970.
Ms. Magazine.
In 1972, and then you've got this sort of feminist version in the Linda Carter television series, which I guess ran for three seasons in the mid and late 1970s. And so it's a character who's gone through a number of different iterations, in her timeline.
Well, again, but that's true of all of these superheroes. The ones that have kind of made an impact.
Yeah, but Batman never decided to become like a domestic and say, fighting crime, I'm not going to do that now. Whereas Wonder Woman actually, I think that the swings in Wonder Woman are probably even more profound.
Right, sure.
Than,
we need to get to the movie, but I'm interested in a couple of things, I guess. You're right. She has this, the character has kind of, we can map her onto the history of feminism in the United States in interesting ways. And I think it is revealing that we haven't had a film until now. There were some controversies surrounding the film. Before we talk about the film itself, I'm thinking about Well, there are two in particular that have really cropped up. One is there were all female showings of the film at certain cinemas in the United States. In places, it must be said, like Austin, Texas, and Brooklyn.
Yeah.
which are fine places, I want to stress. But there was a backlash inevitably online with some men objecting online to the fact that there were all female viewings, screenings of the film. Mm. The other is because the star of the film, Gal
Gadot,
is Israeli.
Yes.
I think she does a wonderful, she's brilliant. But because she is Israeli, in some Muslim countries...
Yeah, I think in Lebanon.
Like in Lebanon, they weren't showing it. They didn't show it in Ramallah, which one can understand, in the occupied territories. Or in the Palestinian Authority, I should say. They have also talked about, I think Tunisia was another place. Yeah. So there have been some controversy about whether to screen it in the Islamic world that has nothing to do with the feminist agenda. So it's been controversial because of the star in certain places and because of these all-female screens. Mm. What do you think of these controversies, David?
The all-female screening, I think that's mostly angry men on Twitter being angry men on Twitter, so I don't think that's...
Wait, there are angry men on Twitter?
I've heard tell. They tend not to attack me, so I'm less familiar with them than most people. I don't think that's something that's worth...
The New York Times did an interesting story before the screening in Brooklyn where they were talking to the women who were there about why they were there, and it was fascinating. Actually, I would commend that to people to have a look at. We should link to it on our page.
Okay. But what was their explanation?
They said, you know what? It's nice to be in an audience that's all female where we can enjoy this film. They also said because there was a backlash about Gal Gadot's. Body type that she was not sort of voluptuous enough to play Wonder Woman, according to some people. When the film was being made, when she was cast, as one woman said, "In the I don't want to be with a bunch of snickering 12-year-old boys talking about her body."
Yeah,
and it's a point well taken as well. I don't have a problem with the all-female screenings necessarily either, but some people really did. They say, oh, what's next, an all-male screening of Thor? These are the problems we face.
Yes. I guess Gal Gadot was in the Israeli Defense Force, like everybody in Israel at some point. I think that was the specific objection of Lebanon. All big films like this are going to have some kind of controversy because I think any film that's trying to make a political statement and reach a mass audience, as this film is.
Okay, do you believe it's making a political statement?
I think Wonder Woman has always made a political statement. I think the character has always been inherently a political character, and the fact that you've got one of these big budget films that's directed by a woman, big budget sort of superhero films that's directed by a woman, and where a lot of the tropes of these films are being, there's a gender inversion. Like there's an interesting scene with Chris Pine where he doesn't have any clothes on and it sort of is an inversion of, the male gaze that you tend to find in most of the superhero films, having that inverted. I think it's definitely a film that's trying to make not all that subtle political statement, but a political statement nonetheless.
It was disconcerting to me, and we don't want any plot spoilers because...
Oh, yes, we don't want to.
So we have to be careful about that. But one thing that I found disconcerting was that Robin Wright plays a key role as she plays Wonder Woman's aunt.
Yes.
And trains her as a child. And of course, it's very hard not to think, hey, that's Claire Underwood.
Or Princess Buttercup.
Right, okay.
Yeah, she went from the helpless princess that need rescuing to somebody who clearly doesn't need rescuing.
No, indeed. So let's talk about the film itself.
Yeah.
What did you think?
I really liked it. I really, given the recent history of DC films, I went into it with very low expectations about...
Yes, let's not forget Superman versus Batman. What a train wreck that was.
Or Suicide Squad, which was worse. If you hadn't seen either of those movies, don't. They're both really awful. Suicide Squad in particular is
Anyway, focus, David.
Ranks any bad of the films. I thought they made some interesting choices. I think probably the most interesting, you know, the beginning of the film does tell the origin story in a fairly traditional way of you know, Steve Trevor's plane crashing and being, you know, rescued on Wonder Woman's island. The mascara, I think, is the version of the island they use in the movie. And then she goes back with him into the world of man. The interesting choice that they made was putting in World War One and not in World War Two.
Yes, I thought that was very interesting.
And I was curious about, obviously, Wonder Woman was created during World War Two, or at least right before World War Two, in the era of World War Two, as was the, you know, the these other superheroes. We've had superhero movies with origin stories in World War II. We've had, you know, Captain America's, you know, World War II. I was curious why you thought they did that.
I'm not sure. I mean, to be honest with you, I mean, you're right. It's, it really is an origin story.
Yeah.
And it reminded me of the Wolverine origin film that was made you know, in the X-Men series a few years ago. I don't know why they chose World War One. I mean, I thought it was interesting. I thought on a number of levels. Of course, we are commemorating the centenary of the First World War, and so it resonates in that way.
And the U.S. entry in, you know, is 100 years exactly.
Right? That's right. So, although it, well, there was curiously an American Indian there, and that wasn't it wasn't clear to me why he was there. Yeah. But. It's not a very American-focused film, apart from Chris Pine's character, who's an American who works for British intelligence.
Yes. There are parts of that that all, like, historically all fall apart.
Of course. But what was interesting was it wasn't about Americans in World War One.
No.
It was about the British in World War One, if anything. I thought the choice of the First World War was interesting, and it wasn't entirely clear to me why they did it, but I thought it was interesting given the current moment we're in. The thing I'd say about it is historiographically, well, if we think about the portrayal of Wonder Woman as reflecting different historical periods, the version of World War One that we got was very, very traditional historiographically.
Yes.
So the Germans were the bad guys. It's been a long time since we had a film with the Germans as just bad guys.
Yeah.
And it was very much a vision of World War One, of the First World War, which is kind of was... predominant in the middle of the 20th century, which is the Germans were the aggressors, the Germans caused this war, and the British and their allies are the good guys.
Yeah.
And it was very much that. There was an inherent contradiction in at the heart of this film, which is she supposedly believes in peace and love, but she's fighting, basically she's fighting to end war.
Yes.
Which goes to, I suppose, I'm riffing now, but it's the Woodrow Wilson interpretation of World War One, the war to end all wars, which is a phrase that's used in the film. So she's waging war along with Steve Trevor, played by Chris Pine, to end war. So they're waging war to end war. And there's an inherent contradiction there. I thought Chris Pine was really, really good, and he reminded me... And he's been very good. He was very good in the Star Trek films, the reboot playing Captain Kirk.
And in Hell and High Water.
Oh, he was very good in that. Well, playing a totally different character there. But he reminded me of a kind of Harrison Ford as Indiana Jones a little bit. There was a kind of element of that. He played the kind of dashing hero with a bit of humor quite well. Don't want to spoil the ending, so I won't say any further about that. But I thought the interpretation of World War One, and maybe it is this war to end all wars concept that makes it work as World War One. That just occurred to me.
That wouldn't work with World War Two.
No. But it was a curious choice because, frankly, you don't see that many films about set in World War One.
Although we're about to have, there's a big one coming out soon, with the name of which escapes me. Christopher Nolan's got it.
Right, but we're getting Dunkirk.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. Yeah.
No, that's World War II, David.
Oh, sorry. No, there's a World War I film coming.
No, there's we're getting the Dunkirk film very soon, and the Winston Churchill film very soon. And so there's a revival of Second World War films, but particularly British Second World War films coming, which is interesting.
The choice to make it World War One, I think, is interesting in as much as I think part of you know, what they were trying to say is this is a war that's fundamentally different from something that's happened before. That this does look like it's the beginning of the end of everything, right? You know, whereas you can't say that in a World War II film. But I think that explains why she doesn't have the invisible jet.
Right, right, sure. I'm just telling you, the Wonder Woman fundamentalist I saw it with was very disappointed about that.
Invisible hot air balloon or something. You know, right, well. You know, and they are playing with lots of sort of traditional Wonder Woman villains, like you know, Dr. Poison and whatnot are there. Are there things that you think didn't work in the film?
No, I actually, I mean, it's not the greatest film ever made.
Right, no,
but I went thinking, okay, this is a summer blockbuster. It's a superhero movie. You're right. It does have a political.
I actually didn't like the ending. I don't want to talk about the ending, but I didn't think that it worked as effectively.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things I liked was, which is the opposite of the question you asked me, I realize, but is. The plot was important, and we don't want to get to, what the combating evil and all this kind of thing, but the fate of the world was at stake in a kind of metaphorical way. Mm-hmm. They were fighting against war, but too often now they up the stakes with every single film where the villain has some scheme that endangers the entire Earth.
Or the universe,
or what have you. And that wasn't this. Was, okay, the baddies are going to do this and perpetuate the war, we have to stop them. And so it was a kind of more, if you will, reasonable plot. Yes. All these plots are absurd, of course, by definition. But I thought the scale of it was good. I take your point about the ending. I don't want to say too much about that. I didn't... Well, again, I don't want to spoil it, but on the whole, I was pretty satisfied. I was very pleased. Although, as I said,
I enjoyed seeing Ewan Bremmer in something that wasn't Trainspotting.
Yes, yes. Well, and they did get casting right. So there's a curious group of kind of anti-heroes who surround her. And this is casting. This is the way Hollywood used to do things. It's for tokenism.
Yes.
So there's an Arab, there's a Scotsman, and there's a Native American.
You sing some Robbie Burns.
Yes, but they're all played by people who are actually of those groups. Because you,
yes, which
no brown face or black face.
Now, which is sort of, I guess, the same was true for the sort of people in the first Captain America movie, where you've got sort of the team of people who are, representing the sort of demographic diversity, which of course isn't true of fighting groups in either world war, where people tend to fight in segregated units.
Right, but one thing we know from the recent scholarship on the First World War is the very diversity of what was happening in terms of the... And so you saw that in some of the scenes where there were kind of Indian troops in London. African troops in the trenches. Fight together, you're right. Right.
So I thought actually that was an impressive recognition that London, in 1917... was a much more diverse place than I think often it's depicted.
Yeah, that's right. And it wasn't the kind of Dick Van Dyke, Mary Poppins London. But it was... I really liked the portrayal of London in 1917. Yeah. In some respects, those were the best scenes. And the kind of classic trope of the comedy of the fish out of water.
Yes.
So her coming to London and trying on conventional clothes and seeing a corset and saying, oh, is this armor that women wear? But they did all that. In fact, a little more of that would have been quite interesting because it was quite, Crocodile Dundee. A million films have done it.
Yes.
Spock and Star Trek. And, it's been done many times before, but I thought she did it really well. She's a very good actress, actually. She did the kind of comedic things quite well. Yeah. I thought she had good chemistry with Chris Pine. Yeah. I would give it 2 thumbs up.
No, I would too. Did you notice that when they were on Themyscira that all of the... other actresses there embrace the Israeli accent?
Yes. So she, yes. The
Amazons all speak with an Israeli accent.
That's true. Yeah. And there was a bit of the choreography of the fight, especially when they're on the island, very reminiscent of Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, for those who've seen that film. So there's a lot there. It's worth seeing.
Yes. All right. Time for last drops. Frank, what do you got?
I want to recommend another podcast, David. I want to recommend a program that's been airing on BBC Radio 4 here in the UK, but it's available as a podcast called Our Man in the Middle East. And it's an account by Jeremy Bowen, who's a very, very, he's an excellent BBC journalist who's mainly been in the Middle East for the past 25 years, or 26 years, actually. And it's in 25 parts. They're 15 minutes each, so you can listen to them quite easily while you're, you know, doing the dishes or what have you. And he takes you through the, basically, the narrative arc is his experience in the Middle East since 1991, but it's also, of course, it coincides with the engagement of the United States in a military way in the Middle East in the same period, much of which he's covered. Some of it's quite harrowing. It's really, really fine journalism, and it's a really interesting example of contemporary history. Okay. Strongly recommend it. It's not done yet. There are going to be, I think, 25 episodes, but I strongly... Our Man in the Middle East with Jeremy Bowen on BBC Radio 4.
All right, I'm going to have to put that on my list of things to listen to, which is growing.
What about you, Dave?
So, I want to endorse a historic site, which I urge people to visit, or two historic sites in some ways. I encourage people to visit soon, and I'll get to the why soon at the end. And that's Jamestown. You've been to Jamestown, yes. So there's
don't watch the TV program. It's horrible.
I have not watched it yet. All right, I've not seen the TV program, but now I won't. So there's actually two sites if you go to Jamestown to see it. There's the archaeological site, the original location of Jamestown, where they've got, you can see, these are the foundations of buildings. And they've got a very nice museum there where they talk about cannibalism and all the kinds of fun things. And they've also got a separate site a couple miles down the road, which is the recreation built in 1907 for the 300th anniversary, where they've got this, you can actually, you know, they've rebuilt the fort and the dock and the whole thing, and you can see it. And both sites are definitely worth visiting. They're wonderful. You can do them both in a day. There's a debate on which one you should visit first to get a sense of the thing. But one of the great things you can do at both sites is you can go out to the river, the James, and look out across the river, and it's largely unspoiled. It looks more or less like it would have looked 400 years ago. And it's pretty easy to get yourself lost in that sort of historical time travel. The reason why I think you should visit soon is there is a plan in place right now to put a series of high-tension electric cables over the James River, basically right where the sites are, which will spoil that view. And there's a fight going on now between the local power company in Virginia that says we need to put up these electric cables, and historic sites that say it will decimate this sort of relatively pristine landscape. And I don't know how that's going to unfold, but if you're in the neighborhood, definitely go visit Jamestown.
Yeah, I would endorse that, but I'm surprised they can't put them underground.
But there's a river, it's complicated. Okay,
but I'm not an engineer.
Exactly. Among the things we're not, yeah. Our engineers.
Should we announce our...
So we got some things going up in the near future. So Frank, you've got a solo show coming up here at the National Library of Scotland on the 3rd of July. Do you want to tell people about
it? Yes, I'm going to be offering my reflections on the first 6 months of the Trump administration.
In the back heckling.
At the National Library of Scotland on the 3rd of July at 2 o'clock. Okay. So if you're in Edinburgh and you want to attend that, you can find tickets. They're free via the library's website, but it's an Eventbrite site. So you can either go via Eventbrite and search for it, or go to the National Library of Scotland.
But they're free, and Frank's events tend to sell out. So, you know.
Frank's a big sellout. And then we've also got another event, David. We're doing a live event, and we're doing our first live episode of the Whiskey Rebellion on August 16th.
August 16th, and this is part of the university's contribution to the Edinburgh Festival Fringe. So it's going to be, in the midst of all kinds of comedy shows and burlesque shows and singing and dancing and us doing our podcast.
Yeah, we're going to keep our clothes on. We want to get sure our listeners are.
Although I saw that we're scheduled to have it in the Anatomy Lecture Theater, which is this historic where our offices are in the old medical school. So this is where they used to do dissections for the medical students. And yep. So
So please come, bring your questions. So that is August 16th at 1 o'clock.
Yes.
Are there ticket details yet? Or
I think that is to come shortly. I think they're still sort of working out the mechanics of all that. But,
well, we hope to see you all there. And we're actually in talks with the History Society here at the university about doing a series of live events.
Yeah, so if you want to see what we look like and meet us in person and have us autograph something or whatever it is you want to do.
Yes, we'll autograph your podcast.
Here's your iPhone.
Let's wrap it up, dude.
All right. As always, you can follow us on Twitter at Whiskey Rebel Pod. We're also on Facebook. You can follow us or download episodes on iTunes, Stitcher, or Podbean. Until next week, Frank.
Cheers, David.
Cheers.